everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. Today, we're talking about plastic people in a liquid world.
This is an amazing phrase that I love from the final chapter of Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. We've been talking about this book a little bit on the podcast, and I decided we're just going to jump ahead to the last chapter and talk about what Carl Truman sees as the church's responsibility. So here's what happened for me. We've been talking about this book. I've recommended the book. People have been giving me grief because it uses words like prolegomena, and they're like, what does that mean?
You know, that's a big word.
People are like, Bob, this book takes a little more intellectual time than you kind of gave the sense that it did. But I saw somebody on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, who said, hey, buy this book and read the last chapter first, and it will help you understand why the rest of the book is important. And I thought that's a really good counsel, because if you're not into intellectual history, reading a book like this, you sort of bog down. You're like, okay, I understand you're making a case, but you're starting with Rousseau and the Romantics, and you're talking about Freud, and you're talking about Marx. And if you're not intrigued by sort of all that stuff, it can feel like you get bogged down in it. So I thought we're just going to jump ahead to this last chapter, because this is where Carl Truman sort of tells us as Christians, hey guys, here's what we're going to need to do in the years ahead in light of the case that I'm making about what's happening in the world around us. On page 384 of The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Carl Truman uses this phrase, plastic people in a liquid world. And that's a great, I like that phrase because it is a summary of what he is saying in the entire book. He's saying we are plastic people, meaning our identity is in flux. We are shaped by the world around us. No longer is there a core essential human nature. No longer is there something sort of transcendently true about us. We're free to sort of remake ourselves according to our preferences. This is how the modern world views the self. That's his whole point. This is the modern self. It's a plastic self. It's a malleable self. And the modern world is a liquid world. And what he means by that is because we've lost any sense of what he calls a sacred order or transcendent values culturally, we just have this constant liquidity. It's like things are just always evolving and changing, and kind of whatever is newest is truest. Whatever sort of wins the day is kind of how people imagine the world is. And I thought that was a really helpful phrase to sort of summarize the point Carl Truman is trying to make. Hey, we have become plastic people in a liquid world. What does it mean to live in that reality? So I want to talk briefly about what Carl Truman does here in this final, it's not even a chapter. He calls it the concluding unscientific prologue, which I think is a funny title.
Well, and to be fair, the book has a couple different endings.
Yeah.
He's like, I could have ended here.
It's like an epilogue
here,
and then a concluding unscientific prologue. So yeah, he where he starts this is the very last section of the book. Literally, if you turn the page, you're in the index. So it really is the last word of the last word of the book. He says, hey, I started this book by declaring that it was not to be read either as a lament or as a polemic. So he's saying, I've been chronicling all these shifts in how we think about the self, and you could read that as a lament, sort of pining for the good old days, or you could read it as a polemic of like, let's fight for something different. And he's saying, I didn't mean it to be either. I mean it to be just a description, an explanation of how we got to where we are. Here's what he says. It is a basic practical truth that we live in this world at this time, and therefore we are required to respond to the problems we face in the context in which we find ourselves. So what he's saying is, hey, don't read this as a lament. Don't read it as a polemic. Read it as a way to find your footing in the world we actually live in. Here we are. We're living in this world. We have to live for Christ in the midst of this context. I'm trying to help you understand what that's going to require. I want to go to the very end of this section. So he does two things in this section. He says, here's some possible futures. Here's where I could see culture going. And he talks about where is the view of marriage going? Where is transgenderism going? Where is religious freedom going? He kind of gives some sense of like, here's where I think these things are headed for us. And there's very interesting things to talk about there. And maybe we'll come back and talk about those. But on the very last 5 or 6 pages of the book, he says, what does the church need to do in this moment? In light of all that we've talked about, in light of the rise and triumph of the modern self, what should the church be doing at this present moment? He says, briefly, I would suggest 3 things that should mark the church as she moves into the future. So if you're a church leader, here's your marching orders. If you're a Christian, here's what you should be caring a lot about. If you're a thoughtful Christian trying to make disciples and live as a disciple in the modern world, here are 3 things Carl Truman thinks are going to matter greatly going forward. First, the church should reflect long and hard on the connection between aesthetics and her core beliefs and practices. So the call to action is reflect on the connection between aesthetics and the church's core beliefs and practices. Let me frame out what he's saying a little bit here. When he talks about aesthetics, what he's saying is we live in a world, the modern world is a world where images have primacy over ideas. What matters is how people feel about things. That's the aesthetic sensibility. It's it has less to do with what's true, what's real, what can be proven, what can be verified, and more to do with what's cool. What's hip? What's interesting? What feels right to me? And he says, so we live in a world where aesthetics are the basis of people's reasoning. And therefore, the church needs to do 2 things. One, we need to double down on truth and doctrine and real objective reality. However, we also need to think about how to do that in a way that values story, in a way that prioritizes the journey that people are on. So he's trying to thread an interesting needle here. He's saying, we don't want to just say, well, the culture around us is aesthetic, so let's just let the church posture itself in that category, because then we sort of lose the conviction that has always grounded the church, that the church is about doctrine, it's about orthodoxy. There really is a true vital center that's grounded and the church needs to hold on to. But he also says, hey, what wins the day in our culture is people's stories. Why do we have such a thing as Instagram influencers? Because people are into story. People like following people's journey. People like looking at photographs and admiring people and getting pulled into the world they live in. That's that aesthetic sensibility. And he sort of suggests that the church is going to need to learn how to both resist that while also understanding how to leverage that for the sake of the gospel.
So a book that I'm reading that I forgot to mention on our last podcast about what we're reading is a book called Deep Discipleship by J.T. English. And one of the premises of that book is that the church needs to give more emphasis to biblical literacy, that he doesn't knock small groups, but I think it's a really important point is he points out that, hey, the small group structure that kind of came out of, you know, whenever that happened, 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, was built within a structure where there was already biblical literacy. And so what essentially has happened to the church is we've lost a lot of that foundation. And if we're going to have a deeper sense of who we are as Christians, what we believe, have that grounding that Truman is calling us to in truth, that we need to recapture biblical literacy. And so in some ways it's going back to that. Are we teaching? Isn't necessarily mean, hey, go start Sunday schools, but are there contexts besides Sunday morning where people are engaging truth in a way that isn't just, hey, talk to me about your story or talk to me how you're applying it, but actually laying a foundation. Hey, this is the truth of Christianity. Yes, we want to work that into our lives and live those out and speak into our story, but there's got to be a place just for the ideas to be established and laid down in the church. And that was very provoking for me as a pastor and thinking through our discipleship structures of like, how are we going to reclaim truth and double down on truth and establish a biblical literacy for our people to stand on?
That's really good. It's a good application of what Truman is talking about. His second application or call to the church is she must be a community. And what he says here is the probably the most compelling thing the church can be in the modern world is just a real flesh and blood community of relationships. Here's his observation. If the message about the self is that of expressive individualism or psychological man, and if that message is being preached from every commercial, every website, every newscast, and every billboard to which people are exposed on a daily basis, the task of the church in cultivating a different understanding of the self is likely to provoke despair. What he's saying is, it's going to be really hard for the church to work against the constant messaging all the time that expressive individualism is what matters. So if the church is going to do deep discipleship, if we're going to establish a different vision of the self, the only way that's going to actually take root is for people to see it and experience it lived out in community with other people. Because we can't possibly merely fight at the level of information. We can't simply preach better sermons and therefore counteract the messaging that people are getting every day, every hour, from every billboard, every commercial, and every conversation. And so the church has to build and be a strong and healthy community, which this is really, this has always been something that I've been compelled by and trying to build as effectively as we can. But it makes me ask the question again, how can we do better at this? How can we double down on this? How can we continue to try to help the community at the center of the church be rich and healthy and robust and life-giving and humane? It feels to me like that really is going to be the vital center of any kind of meaningful Christian mission going forward.
I like what he says in that same section, Bob, that you were talking about and reading from. The world in which we live is now witness to communities in flux. And basically he's saying like, that's also our hope in the fluctuation of the culture that we're swimming in. I think what he's getting at is if we put down roots and stay stable and have what we call, you know, we use the phrase faithful presence a lot, then that will eventually be a stabilizing force in people's lives.
Yeah. He jokes about, he says bizarre phrases such as online community. actually makes sense because we know how the very idea of community has been evacuated of the notion of bodily proximity and presence. He's like, what in the world is an online community? That doesn't even make sense. But it does in a world where, yeah, if you're present or not doesn't really matter because you're a plastic person.
And post COVID, yeah. I mean, churches now are going to be like, we're hearing this now. Like, well, we attended online for a while.
Yeah, we decided
to come.
Yeah. That's my new favorite phrase to make fun of you people for saying we've been attending online for a while.
Yeah.
No, that's not a category. You can't attend something online.
It's not even
a category.
Have you talked to your pastor and you're like, well, I did listen to the Wednesday conversation. So it's kind of the same.
Yeah, it's not talking. It's listening.
But this is the world we're in.
Yeah.
Like you're going, this is happening. You're going to attend online before you come to church.
And with that, I appreciate the challenge that he admits is that with the plethora of choices that we have for churches, even within one denomination, even if, you have a very narrow theological lens, but you have multiple options, that we're going to have to fight against the tendency to just sort of turn church into this consumable product to where the moment something happens that I don't like, I'm church hopping. Because when you do that, you uproot yourself from that deep community that you need, that strong community that you need. And so in some ways, us Protestants have to stop being our own worst enemies in this and stop treating the church like just a product that I'm consuming and actually see it as this is a community that either the world is going to shape me or I'm going to embed in a community that's actually shaping me into the image of Christ and make that decision and fight against some of those impulses when it's so easy. You think of this even just at the level of like ministry leader, pastor. The moment my church is starting to upset me or I'm not liking how things are going, what can I do? I can get on.
Be a plumber.
I can go be a plumber. Or I can go get on I could go leave ministry or I could go hop on, a church job website and go, oh, this church needs a pastor. I can just sort of, go that and uproot everything.
If I do that every Monday, it's not necessarily a good thing. Well, I'm kidding. I don't do that every Monday.
That's another, maybe that's another podcast. Talk about those things. Cause I mean, yeah, who hasn't done that?
Well, it is. So we're going to get to the third prescription, but what you're saying reminds me of something Truman points out in this chapter, which is he says, hey, we have to be careful as Christians that we understand we are also being shaped by this as well.
Yeah.
I'm writing about it as though it's a reality we can analyze and sort of stand away from, but actually every one of us is shaped by this world of expressive individualism. And the patterns you're pointing out is exactly what he's saying. It's like, if you look at how we view the church, how easy it is for us to leave a church and go to another one, how endless our options are, and how we tend to choose churches based on worship style or, you know, these factors that are, you know, they matter at some level, but they're not core orthodoxy type things. We need to understand that every one of us is in this world, and there's a sense in which we are a plastic self too. And so we have to be careful that we don't talk as though like, oh yeah, that evil world out there is trying to make us that. No, we actually, this is our world that we live in. And so we're going to have to be self-aware of the ways that consumerism, individualism, the sort of constant state of flux in a liquid world are shaping every one of us as well.
Yeah. And even the way you lead your church, like how are you, the changes you make or the particular theological applications that you make, or, you know, when I was reading this chapter, this is one of the thoughts that came to mind. I was just like, I think of First City Church and our theological beliefs, our practices, and how much, I'm not saying that we're pragmatists in this, but how much we sort of swim in different streams. And I think that's beautiful and great, but there's also this sense of there is a freedom to express ourselves and sort of pick those things and kind of even make a stamp of, hey, we're kind of unique in this way. If done well, I think done groundedly, that can be a beautiful thing. But if we're not careful, we're running the same problem of now we can just sort of, well, we don't really need this anymore. Let's just throw that, or, oh, let's take this thing on and kind of change things so it's more palatable to people. And so there's also a danger, even, you know, trying to be theologically and historically grounded in the swimming in this expressive individualism and just sort of assuming it's sort of the air you breathe and sort of your kind of base operating manner. And if you're not aware of it, all of a sudden you're sort of living by it in ways that aren't helpful.
All right. Here's his third prescription. Protestants need to recover both natural law and a high view of the physical body. This, man, I want to preach a sermon on this. I've been pondering this for probably a decade, the reality of natural law and how Protestants have been really, really weak in this category. I think we've talked about this before. It's one of the reasons we like Bavinck, because we've said Protestants tend to be very biblicist in how they think. So if I'm trying to argue for, is something true or not, is something right or not, we've sort of taught ourselves to look for Bible verse. Like, give me a Bible verse, show me where the Bible says this is true. And Truman is saying, hey, we have to recover the reality of natural law, because natural law actually is a biblical category. Calvin wrote about it, for goodness sake. And it helps us in a world where transcendence no longer is a value, nor is authority a value, nor is tradition a value. We're going to have to disciple people in embracing not just what the scripture says about things, but the way that conforms to natural law. The obvious categories here are things like gender. I was just reading the prophet Jeremiah this morning, and I can't remember, it's in chapter 31 or 32. There's a section where the prophet Jeremiah, the holy scriptures, asked the question, can a man give birth? And it's like, it's a rhetorical question. And the implied answer is no. And then God goes on to say, neither can my people change their behavior. It's like a way of bringing a judgment against his people. And the point is, the appeal there is to natural law. It's like, well, no, women give birth, men don't give birth. But if you think about where our culture is right now, right, that very question is up for debate. Because what does it mean to be a man or to be a woman? What does it mean to have a womb or not to have a womb? What does it mean to have a body that you can, through surgery, remake into a different kind of body? And so Truman is saying here that not so much for our apologetics, for speaking to the culture, But for discipling our own congregations and our own selves, we've got to elevate the importance of natural law to say, hey, what the Bible teaches about gender, sexuality, and reality match what the world teaches us, that the natural created order teaches us about gender and sexuality and reality. And this category, our kids need this, our converts need this, our disciples need this in order to embrace with conviction the truth of a sexual ethic that's going to feel very countercultural. He goes on to say, sorry, Dusty, I just interrupted you. He goes on to say, this is connected to the importance of the body, right? We are embodied beings, and the nature of the body says something to us about what God is like.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He says, but to tear identity away from physical embodiment and to root it entirely in the psychological, which, by the way, is what Protestants are really good at, living in their head, would be to operate along the same trajectory as transgenderism. I wish he would have said more here. I mean, he does talk a lot about the body, obviously, throughout in light of the LGBTQ stuff. But I've been thinking a lot, partly because of Rich Plass, on being an embodied soul.
Yeah.
And the Lord giving you a body and that being part of the worship experience that you have with him. And so it's I'd like, I'm embarrassed to say that it's like a new concept to me over the last probably 3 years. But it is highly important. And then your body actually absorbs stress. Your body is absorbing all it. And we act like we can just think our way out of it.
Yeah.
And it's just not true.
One of the best books I've read in the last 20 years is Christopher West's book, The Theology of the Body, which is a Catholic book. But what it's just basically saying, there is a theology implicit in your embodiedness. And when we understand that, it helps us teach things like sexual ethics. This book is intended, I think, for or was first written with an audience of college students and high school students in mind, of helping them understand, why does the Bible give us the sexual ethic it does? It's not just, here's a Bible verse on how to stay sexually pure. It's, here's what it means to have a body and to inhabit a body and to have a body that is a sexual body and to have a body that's meant to glorify God in its existence and in how it's used and how it's not used. It's a really powerful and profound work.
And you have to go to the Catholics to find stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what Truman's saying. He's like, hey, Protestants, we're going to have to recover a healthy doctrine, theology of the body. All right, here's where we're going to land the plane. He ends the last two pages of this 407-page book. Here we go. What age provides a precedent for the one in which we live? He's saying, hey, where do we go in church history to sort of find, where can we look for a model of what it's going to look like for us to practice Christian faithfulness in this liquid world full of plastic people? Here's his answer. The second century.
That's really old, Travis.
It's further back than the 70s.
That's before the 70s. Yeah.
The second century, which I love. I'm so excited about this because it does feel to me like the more I've studied the church fathers and the early church, there is this resonance with the modern world, and here's why. He says, in the second century, the church was a marginal sect within a dominant pluralist society. She was under suspicion, not because her central dogmas were supernatural, but rather because she appeared subversive in claiming Jesus as king. This is where we are today. This book indicates how a pluralist society has slowly adopted beliefs about sexuality and identity that render Christianity immoral and inimical to the civic stability of society as now understood. The second century world is, in a sense, our world, where Christianity is a choice, and a choice likely at some point to run afoul of the authorities. And then here's the last chapter, or the last paragraph of the book. It was that second century world that laid down the foundations for the later successes of the third and fourth centuries. And she did it by what means? By existing as a close-knit, doctrinally bounded community that required her members to act consistently with their faith and to be good citizens of the earthly city as far as good citizenship was compatible with faithfulness to Christ. How we do that today is a question beyond the scope of this volume. So he's saying, I don't know how we do that today, but I'm just saying, go look at the second century and pay attention to what they did. Here's what I like. I want to read that again. A close-knit, doctrinally bounded community. So think about close-knit in terms of the relationships, doctrinally bounded in terms of orthodoxy, that required her members to act consistently with their faith. So there's an integrity of life demanded here. And to be good citizens of the earthly city, as far as good citizenship was compatible with faithfulness to Christ. So, hey, be a great citizen at every way, place you can, except where it costs you faithfulness to Christ. And I think it's really interesting to think about how that prescription or that vision, how does it change what we do as leaders? It means we're fighting for close-knit community. It means we're holding to sound doctrine. It means we expect people to live a life that matches their profession, which is challenging in the modern world. And it means we want to teach them to be good citizens of the earthly city. And those things are, they require a different kind of leadership and a different kind of investment in people than perhaps what we've been doing or what the church in America has traditionally done for the last few decades. And so I think it was a really interesting prescription there. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think?
So this spring, we're going to be jumping back into 1 Corinthians, and we're going to be particularly going through chapters 5-7. And what's reading this was, I've been studying some of the kind of getting ready for that, and reading this felt very much kind of paralleling to some of the stuff the Apostle Paul was getting into in especially 1 Corinthians 5 with the whole issue of church discipline.
Yeah.
And what is at stake in church discipline is this very thing of not allowing the world to shape the church. And what is the central issue is sexual ethics and the ways that why is 1 Corinthians so quote unquote obsessed with sexual ethics is because the world that these converts were coming out of had basically a no holds barred view of sex and how that was beginning to influence the church. And there's even, some debate around, in 1 Corinthians 5 with the guy sleeping with his stepmom, like, what does it mean that the church was arrogant about that? That they, they didn't care about it? Or maybe they even saw that, hey, this was actually this is fine. Yeah, this is how progressive we are. So just even thinking about the parallels of, this is the first century church, but just what is at stake for us in being that tight-knit community that actually calls people to live their profession of faith and how vital that is. If we're going to be this strong community, we have got to care deeply about being a community that the gospel actually transforms our ethics and our life. Otherwise, we're going to just dissemble and be another one of those shifting, moldable communities that just kind of morphs into whatever and eventually just dissipates.
And we have to have the kind of relationships that can sustain people who are called to walk roads of sacrifice or roads of difficult discipleship, right? What if your family disowns you? What if you're walking in celibacy in a situation where that's challenging for you? What if you have trauma in your background and need a safe community where you can actually develop trust? All of that can't just come through the right doctrine. It comes through a certain quality of life together where those kinds of choices and sacrifices can be sustained over time and where there's real familial kind of bonds. And that's the call that the church needs to be. And it remains to be seen. Can we, broadly speaking, become that in a way that's compelling? I think by God's grace, the answer is yes, but it's certainly not the same things the American church has been giving itself to for the past few decades.
Yeah. It's funny how in 1 Corinthians 5, you have this, hey, expel this person because of the influence of sin. And so this, importance of purity, but then you get into chapter 6 and like, hey, don't sue each other.
Yeah.
It's the very thing.
Figure it out in the church.
Yeah. It's the very thing you're talking about though, Bob, is that the kind of community that can resolve conflict, that can love each other in the midst of challenge, that can be that strong sense of, hey, we when we deal with sin, we are trying to do this redemptively and we're trying to love each other through the mess and the challenge and the hardship and when we sin against each other. And so purity is not about, just drawing a walls around ourselves, building a fortress and retreating. It's caring deeply about godliness and holiness, but it's also about being a culture of grace and love and forgiveness. And as you were saying, Bob, support and walking with people. And so as we go to the scriptures to find what does this look like lived out in a messy way, in a challenging way, in a hard way, in a way we need the grace of God. We need the gospel through and through, but when we return to God's word, when we're standing on the truth, we have the foundation we need. We have the instruction and the tools we need to build this kind of community.
Plastic people in a liquid world. That's who we are. That's where we're living. And that's the context in which we're called to honor Jesus and preach the Bible and make disciples and live for his glory. So I hope these things provide some fruitful reflection for you in terms of what that is going to look like as we journey forward together. And again, the book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman, if you haven't picked it up yet, you may find it helpful. And starting with the last chapter might help you make it through.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We'd love to hear from our listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.